So when we look at platforms, we're typically looking at the tools, we're looking at the vendor, we're looking at what they're creating and the value that they're providing for all of us to be able to use the tool. But what about the underlying architecture, what it's all built on, what cloud is it running on, or maybe it's running on-prem, if it's, is it using Kubernetes, is it not? And that's exactly what we're going to talk about today with Mark. We're going to be diving into everything from a deep dive perspective on the yellow brick architecture. My name is Michael Levan.
My name is Christina Deochko.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. And super excited to dive into this because I feel like this is the first time we've done this on the podcast. We've had vendors on and such, but we never actually talked to the vendors about what's going on underneath the hood. So this is super exciting.
Be here. Yeah. Looking forward to the discussion.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I need to say that I often, like many engineers out there, maybe are wondering about the specifics of how the tool is built or how a solution is built, like getting that sneak peek behind the scenes. And not so many vendors do necessarily share so much of their details. So that's really nice that you would like to do that as part of our episode. I'm super excited to get that sneak peek.
Well, you know, I think it's absolutely critical that vendors do, and there are so many reasons for that. I mean, when you're installing and using a sophisticated data warehousing capability like ours, there are so many stakeholders involved in a customer that want to know the risks, the implications of installing a stack. You know, there's InfoSec teams to be involved, DevOps, as well as database administrators and so on and so forth. And so we have a very open, honest and transparent view. We want customers to ask those questions and give faithful answers. So it's important.
Mm. And I guess since you're operating mainly with data, this is a totally different level of responsibility in terms of like data security, and customers, I guess, would also ask anyway the specifics of how you're building that so that they can evaluate how secure their data will be on that platform.
Yeah, whenever we're involved in a procurement process or an RFP or something like that, so we're asked questions that the CISOs in these companies really need detailed answers for. They want to know what risk they're exposing their company to if they store their most precious data in Yellowbrick, for example. And so it's absolutely critical on us really to provide those answers. And I think it's very different the way that Yellowbrick is installed. So we get into the details and you look at the market today in data warehousing, and most of the vendors out there really deploy software as a service, and they deploy and manage your data in quite an opaque way. You're not exposed, you're not able to understand the architecture and the details at the lowest level. For something like Snowflake or BigQuery, you're not exposed as a customer for those kinds of details. Now, with Yellowbrick, we actually deploy our stack directly in a customer's own cloud account. So they effectively have full access to our software at the individual nut and bolt level. Now, the way that we designed Yellowbrick is that they don't really need to know those details. But from a due diligence perspective, when you're installing a sophisticated software stack in a customer's own cloud networking environment, their security teams want to know, in many cases down to the minutiae, what it is that we're installing in their account and what risks, if any, they need to account for. And of course, we're open in that they can run any of their container scanning or AMI scanning tools against the Yellowbrick stack because it is running in their cloud account. They own the stack. And so we have to keep on top of the CVEs on a very, very, very regular basis and be completely kind of bulletproof when it comes to from a security perspective.
Yeah, totally makes sense. And I think that, you said a lot of important things, but one of the most important things there that really stood out to me was the transparency. Because, you know, when SaaS first started coming out, that was everybody's biggest kind of concern, right? It was like, what's going on underneath the hood? Like, we have no idea kind of what's happening. And then, you know, the cost perspective, right? So again, giving people the upfront knowledge to say, okay, this is what's going to be deployed. This is what's happening in your environment. Because I feel like maybe we've all been there more or less, where we deploy something and then a month later we get a cloud bill and we get the ingress and egress bills and we're like, oh boy, okay.
don't expose this, Michael. Come on.
I mean,
we don't want to talk about that.
I mean, it's a topic for another podcast, perhaps, when we get into egress fees and these kind of hidden charges. I could talk all day about some of the things I've seen too. But just going back to your point, you know, what I see, and that we made a very conscious product strategy decision to say, we're not offering Yellowbrick as a software as a service offering like many others. We will, and we want you to install it in your own cloud account to really further this idea of a concept we call private data cloud. It's the idea of being able to deploy data warehousing at the point of need based on the data locality, data residency, sovereignty reasons, so that you know that you have a stack that's managing your data that you totally own from top to bottom in a cloud, in a particular cloud. And what's more, also provide a solution that you can deploy within your own data center. And I think this is a really important concept and one that we're seeing a lot of traction for with customers, particularly who are in the regulated industries in financial services or healthcare. They like the idea of owning their entire data within this kind of private data cloud concept. And, you know, I hear stories around how long it takes to get a SaaS solution kind of agreed upon within a CISO's organization. It often takes 18 months of just going through the due diligence. And we're saying, well, you know, you can bypass all that, install the software in your own cloud account, is completely transparent. You know exactly what you're going to install and you know the implications. So I think we're trying to remove a lot of the friction to allow customers to get up and running, manage with the latest modern kind of data warehousing approaches and get up and running as quickly as possible without having to jump all through these compliance hoops.
So I have a few questions from the like end user, maybe not an end user, but like, let's say the administrator or the tech platform team perspective, based on what you have told about how you are installing the data warehouse in public cloud, for example. So you mentioned that the customers don't necessarily need to know the details about that, but you're still allowing them access to those resources that are being deployed. Is that right? So like, can they actually do any modifications, for example, to some of those resources, or they can just view and run things like scanning towards it?
Yeah, we don't encourage kind of customers to go in and tinker with those low-lying components that and services that support Yellowbrick, but they have full access to because they own them. They have spun them up in their cloud account, right? And so you can imagine the process we have today, that we provide a customer in AWS a CloudFormation template, which entirely sets the stack up for Yellowbrick from the very foundations. The kind of you could do from a blank piece of paper, I could take a cloud account, a customer could bring their own cloud account, and they can run the CloudFormation template that will potentially install a VPC. It'll create subnets. It will spin up load balances. It will spin up the Elastic Kubernetes Service, EKS, in AWS on their behalf. It will lay down all of the components for Yellowbrick. It will do all the network configuration. And at the end of that process, they get a link to a URL, which is our web-based UI. And they have not had to stand up any of those individual services themselves. It's all been managed by our installation process. So for kind of those day one operations, we totally manage all of that. And actually, by the way, we're actually kind of going to the next level, and we're just about to introduce a somewhat different installation experience that's entirely based on Kubernetes operators as well, which is going to make day one, day two, and beyond operations in management this even better than it is today. So yeah, they can tinker under the hood. We don't encourage it because, of course, you can break things, right? And you don't need to. You don't need to know the low-level details of how what node groups we've created within Kubernetes to support this entire stack or anything like that. You don't need to know the custom resource definitions that are in place to ensure that our stack matches the sort of declared state of the system and the stack as a whole over time. We manage all of that. They don't have to spin up compute resources, et cetera, or make their own persistent volume claims within Kubernetes to get storage. That's all done by us.
And there was a reason for why I was asking that, because from my experience and from experience of others, I have seen a lot of use cases where if it is open, to be modified, many customers may or many users may start doing that. So that is kind of why I was curious if you actually allow something like that. So when it comes to upgrading the underlying clusters, for instance, and that is all done by you, so the customers don't do that.
Well, it's done by the software. So we provide through our web-based UI a very simple GUI, which allows them to simply upgrade the software, even upgrade the underlying Kubernetes version as well. Because, of course, you know, Azure, Google Cloud, AWS, they're all marching forward, incrementing the Kubernetes version that they support, and sunsetting older versions. And so to make sure our customers are always on a supported version, we have to not only upgrade our software, we have to make sure the underlying infrastructure is upgraded, and our software manages all of that automatically. Customers don't have to go through the AWS console, for example, and do that out of band from Yellow Brick. We manage all of that. So, you know, our thinking from a design perspective was, we don't want to expose customers to these underlying services unless they really need to and they know what they're doing, and we will help them understand in depth how to make changes at that layer. But you don't need to. You know, we want to provide a SaaS-like user experience, but running in a customer's own cloud account.
And this is what what Yellow Brick is calling private data cloud, right?
That's really an enabling target. As I said, really the private data cloud is all about, how do I make sure that I totally own my own data? I can bring the compute and analytics resources to where the data lives, because it has to live there from a security or residency or sovereignty place. I don't want to have to give my data over to a third party SaaS and have them store it in some region of the world that I'm not comfortable with that data being in there. And in fact, more than that, I'm going to get fined if that happens. I want full control of my data. But the flip side, of course, which is almost a contradiction in terms, data sharing is incredibly important. It's a really important use case. I want to be able to share to my customers data, but only the data that I'm comfortable to share and that they need to know. And what we've been working towards in Yellow Brick is a framework and a foundation that allows not only for you to bring the compute and the cloud to where your data is, but also to allow you to safely share that just to the end users and third parties that are eligible to consume that data.
Yeah, so it's the full control aspect versus it's almost one of those things where it's like you have full control, but at the same time, there's so much repeatability happening that you really only need that full control when it's actually necessary, which is really great from, you know, an overall platform engineering perspective, right? It's like one of the biggest things is, here's the thing, take it, go run it, right? Change the values that you need. Like, for example, if you need to change CIDR ranges so there's no overlapping, feel free to do so. But overall, here's the package, go and deploy it, which is obviously very crucial, especially in today's world with a million and one things going on, from a tools and vendors perspective.
I was just going to add to that very quickly, is that you're absolutely right. And every customer has a somewhat slightly different network topology in the cloud, or a different set of security rules and standards that they have to adhere to. And so we've learned a lot over the last 3 years about adapting and being able to make sure our stack is adaptable to fit in with these different networking and security requirements. And that's the overriding kind of constraint, if you like, that we see when we're working with customers.
And thinking about going back to what you were mentioning about the Kubernetes operator, because I got excited about that. So from a Kubernetes deep dive perspective, when you're implementing the operator, is that operator creating resources outside of Kubernetes? So the resources in AWS or in whatever cloud, or is it just creating the resources within Kubernetes itself?
It actually is creating resources outside of just Kubernetes. So obviously, if folks are... Probably everyone knows what an operator is. It provides kind of application-specific extensions to Kubernetes so that you don't have to, from a programming perspective, worry too much about the low-level details of pods and everything like that, but you can extend the capabilities of Kubernetes to encapsulate additional services that you want to manage. But at the end of the day, the operator is responsible from a declarative rather than an imperative perspective for ensuring that the entire Yellow Brick application adheres to this ideal state, okay, and maintains that ideal state. So folks might be wondering why we didn't take the operator approach sort of 3 years ago when we were designing this system. And One of the reasons was we thought we wanted at the time fuller control over how custom resource definitions were maintained. But what really that led to was kind of almost the situation where you can get into split brain situations. We had some of Yellowbrick stack monitoring state over here, and then we had the Kubernetes state over here. And there was a potential for sort of misalignment and disagreement over, you know, is the Kubernetes cluster that's running Yellowbrick actually the same state that Yellowbrick believes it is overall? And so that's something that's really driven us towards working more, immersing ourselves more in the operator world.
And I think the other thing too is like that whole idea of Kubernetes being the underlying platform of choice, like this is becoming a much more popular thing, like especially with tools like Crossplane. You know, like we're seeing it now where various vendors are coming out and it's like, okay, you could use Kubernetes still for your orchestration and this and that, but now you can orchestrate virtual machines and now you can orchestrate literally whatever you want, right? Because to your point with operators, it's your controllers, your CRDs, but you can hit any API that already exists. It doesn't matter as long as it exists or if you need to create it, whatever the case may be. But Kubernetes can literally be the orchestrator for everything. That's what I think the future of it is, but that's another topic.
No, I mean, we wanted to kind of get in the low-level architecture. And I don't know if I want to take a step back and talk about, for example, how the operators enable the stand-up of this entire stack. But to do that, you have to kind of understand what our stack looks like. And Yellowbrick is a database at the end of the day, a SQL, an SQL relational database. So you run your standard select queries with joins and doing things that have been around for kind of 50, 60 years. That's great. But we're doing that in a highly parallel, highly scalable, elastic compute environment now. And, you know, and we're doing it in a stateful environment as well. So many of your kind of viewers, listeners, probably maybe a go-to thinking is, well, Kubernetes is great for stateless applications, but you know, with databases, obviously a stateful application. It turns out there aren't that many stateful implementations of databases in Kubernetes today. And I think Yellowbrick is really pushing the envelope here. But you know, when we build up this stack in the cloud, this automated building block, you know, build out of the foundational components of it, you know, you think of where we're storing our data in the cloud. All the Yellowbrick data that's ingested into our database is stored in object storage like S3 or Blob Store. And that is the kind of that provides us effectively limitless capacity to store data there. And then as you move up the stack, we have compute layer, which is really, of course, orchestrated by EKS. On the demand through API calls or through our UI, a customer creates a compute cluster, which is going to run queries against the data we're storing in S3, of course. And these compute clusters are totally auto-scaled and managed by Kubernetes there. And so as a customer spins these up, Kubernetes acquires the underlying EC2 reservations. If a customer pauses that cluster, we give up those reservations on those EC2 instances, et cetera, et cetera. And then the very top layer of this three-layer stack of storage, compute, and we have our control plane. All of this is running in the customer's cloud account. The control plane is the entry point into Yellowbrick, so queries from business intelligence tools like Tableau or Power BI hit this this top layer, this shared services control plane, and bounce the queries to particular compute clusters that pull the data out of S3 to answer the query. So that's the kind of overall stack. And as I said, all of that is really managed by Kubernetes operators now. And when a customer stands up a stack and maybe a node fails because the underlying EC2 resource has failed, well, then it's the declarative state that is defined within the CRDs that ensures that Kubernetes ultimately spins up another machine, adds it back to the cluster, and the customer can carry on without knowing any of the underlying intricacies.
And like this sounds like the way you're saying as well is that you can run this anywhere. And I think the difference can be a bit significant when it comes to like public cloud providers and their managed Kubernetes service, which is what you are using from what I hear when it comes to public cloud for kind of the Kubernetes. And then if you think about like private cloud in context of customers that is not public cloud vendors, but folks that have their own data centers or maybe just using the bare metal, and there you don't have that managed Kubernetes service type of offering, there you may need to use like the regular, the classic Kubernetes distribution. So this creates quite a complex use case that you have. And I'm curious, like, if you have seen any challenges in terms of your architecture, because we suddenly come to this, topic of how vendor neutral you're going to make it, because in managed Kubernetes services, you get some stuff out of the box, but then you don't get that in others kind of setup. So can you share a bit like of challenges, how this affected your design choices and what things were easier, for instance, were common among the different environments?
Well, I think the portability of Kubernetes buys us 80 to 90% of the heavy lifting. And in fact, by the way, we've actually done this. All of our internal CI/CD testing and whatnot actually takes place on a very, very large on-premises Kubernetes cluster running Yellowbrick, and it's actually running open source Kubernetes. So we already have not only Yellowbrick running on these managed Kubernetes services, but for our own testing, we're running this in our own data center. We have a 300 node Kubernetes cluster that's running Yellowbrick and is doing so successfully today. So we kind of solved those problems. Now, where you get some of the differences and similarities are some of the networking, the CNI stuff might be different. The object storage that we're ultimately addressing is going to be different on premises to in the cloud. But in general, most of the concepts kind of just work. The effort to port between different clouds and even you run Yellowbrick on premises has been relatively straightforward, actually. There haven't been huge differences beyond some of the idiosyncrasies around how networking is enabled on these systems.
So one question that I have around that is, did you ever see any like major hiccups between Kubernetes versions as you were doing upgrades? So like if you were on 126 and you went to 127 or 128, for example, just as an example, right? Was there anything that like broke out of the box that, you were kind of like, oh, I got to go in and do something about this? Or was it always usually just smooth sailing, more or less?
It's been smooth sailing. I'm going to knock on some wood, but as we move, especially now, I mean, look, we're talking about a platform that's 10 years old now in Kubernetes, right? That's mature. I mean, so we really haven't hit any issues as we go from 126 to 127, et cetera, and our customers have gone through that process as well, and we haven't hit that. We've got more work to do on the on-premises side of things. I said we're deploying in our own data center for our own internal purposes on open source Kubernetes. So we're all kind of at the bleeding edge on that. But we're also looking to support some of the commercial on-prem Kubernetes releases like Rancher and OpenShift as well. Because we're seeing a drag. One of the things we want to release later on this year, some of our customers already have their own Kubernetes clusters running. They're running a commercially supported version of Kubernetes on-prem. They want to run Yellowbrick. We want to make sure that they can do that. And so that's something we're working towards for the second half of the year. So basically, productizing what we're using internally today and releasing that for customers to run in their own stacks later this year.
Very cool. And I imagine if you're going through something like trying to get it up and running on Rancher versus trying to get it up and running in the cloud versus trying to get it up and running on-prem, I mean, it's all Kubernetes, but at the end of the day, there's just like so many little subtle differences. Like for example, when you're in the cloud and you expose a load balancer service, you magically have a load balancer, and on-prem you don't. I imagine there was some like pretty crazy and vigorous testing that had to go into that.
There is, and you have to kind of aim sometimes at kind of standardizing across all of these things, like, choosing Nginx and stuff like that for as a common approach to doing things like that, that you can run everywhere. In fact, that's something that we're doing. That there was an actually interesting difference on AWS around how their load balancer works, and the ability to bring your own certificate authority is quite hard to do on AWS with their load balancer versus just bringing your own.
You were talking about some auto scaling stuff before in terms of like spinning up, spinning down worker nodes. Just out of curiosity, is that cluster autoscaler in the back end, or are you thinking about maybe Carpenter now that AKS is incorporating Carpenter?
It's the cluster autoscaler today, but we reserve the right to to change that when things become a supportability. You know, I always come back to what our core business is as a company. We sell database management systems. We sell a database for analytics, right? And so that's our core business. Kubernetes has been fantastic because it's allowed us to concentrate on where our skills really live, which is in the database world and not in the kind of low-level elastic infrastructure for compute that Kubernetes just buys us. So I think and that's not to say that it's not been completely plain sailing. It's been a lot of hard work to bring the skill sets in our company up to be able to develop against Kubernetes and manage these systems in production, which we are doing. But it has allowed us to really place more of our investments on getting the best possible data warehousing product out into the market and less concerned about, you know, having to build elasticity, resiliency, and portability because Kubernetes just kind of buys us that.
I feel like it's almost one of those things where it's like the first time that we're seeing that capability with a platform, you know, because at the end of like, I know we like to say at the end of the day, it's all the same stuff. You know, we've had orchestrators and we've had APIs and we've had VMs and bare metal and yada, yada. But to your point, Kubernetes really brings like this new capability for us. You know, it's kind of like something that we haven't seen before. You know, it's again, it's all the same stuff underneath the hood, but the way that it's designed and the portability, it's drastically different than, you know, more or less anything that we've seen before. Do you kind of agree with that as well?
I do, from the respect that, you know, we've grown up since the fantastic sort of kind of earth moving change that Snowflake made to modernize data warehousing and take it from being a crusty 40-year-old concept into something very exciting, very modern, you know, and the idea of separated compute and storage and data warehousing totally running natively in the cloud. Yeah, when that came out 10 years ago, that really revolutionized the market. Now, where I think Kubernetes brings us is the ability to take that cloudy data warehousing user experience, but also deploy it anywhere. Deploy it on an on-premises system because of data residency requirements and data security requirements. But to a degree with that the fixed platform of hardware it buys you, you get that elasticity, you can get that separated compute and storage, you can get the same experience that you have in AWS running on premises if you want. And I think that's revolutionary. And I think there's going to be an interesting trend. We talked earlier about, you know, these hidden costs of cloud. I think there's going to be an increasingly important conversation about the overall total cost of ownership of data warehousing and indeed other applications in the cloud. You know, there have been a number of high profile blogs recently talking about repatriation. Companies that have taken workloads to the public cloud and are now considering these to be too expensive, too unpredictable. We want to bring those to a more controlled data center that's in our environment that we own. I think over the next 3 years, we're going to see an increasing volume of conversations in those ways. And so what I think is important from any vendor in this space is to give a customer a get out of jail free card here and be able to say, you're not locked into a particular cloud vendor or a particular architecture. The Kubernetes Foundation will allow you to make a choice today, but know that you can move, make sense to your business down the road without compromising. And I think that's going to be an interesting conversation over the next few years.
Yeah, I guess it does give you a strong card and a good plus to your reputation, you can say, as a vendor, if you are taking the design and architectural choices that would allow to exactly say and give that jail-free card. If your solution supports different environments, then this will kind of be a good argument for the customers to keep using your tool, because it would support them making such a decision, for example, if it comes to the point when you decide to go to a different public cloud vendor or go to a private cloud setup, for example. And you would probably have a stronger position by having a solution, a platform that would support such a scenario going forward.
We're trying to make buying decisions for customers a lot easier in this space and really de-risking their decisions at the end of the day. And so if you know with Yellowbrick, you have a platform that I can deploy at the point of need. I can deploy it where, based on, you know, these private data cloud, data sensitivity, residency and locality reasons, I have to deploy in the EU because of GDPR reasons, or there's no public cloud data center in this particular country, but I have my own data center. I want to install it there. again, for data residency purposes. So I can bring my own cloud effectively to Yellow Brick on the one hand. And, I know that I'm not going to be locked in. I know that if my own customer company strategy changes, I'm not going to be in trouble. I can always make changes, go where we need to. If our company's acquired, or, you know, a customer's company is acquired and the parent company is an AWS shop, whereas the, you know, the company is originally was an Azure shop, and everyone decides, well, we've got to move to AWS, and that's not a problem for these acquisitions. And that we see a lot of M&A and these kind of either more complex multi-cloud environments having to come up because of M&A requirements, or the requirement later down to kind of merge towards a single cloud. So flexibility, I think, is critical.
Wrapping up here, I just wanted to ask a quick question. Is there some type of partnership between Intel and Yellow Brick now?
There is. There's been quite a long-standing partnership with Intel, and, you know, we focus all of our deployments on Intel-based VMs in the cloud. So we have early kind of access to the latest Intel CPUs that we can test on, and not only on the hardware CPU side of things, but it actually extends through the software stack as well. You know, Yellow Brick is known for highly efficient, high-performance data warehousing, and that really is a high-performance parallel computing problem at the kind of scales that we're working on. We have parallel compute nodes that are interchanging data during the course of running SQL queries. And what we found is that we needed to optimize the network layer quite considerably. And so we were very early adopters of Intel's data plane development kit, DPDK, which allows us to do effectively zero copy networking as data is interchanged. Now, that sounds kind of a mouthful, but what that really means is, in some cases, customers can see a 70% improvement in their query performance because of the work we've been doing with Intel in AWS, in Azure, and in Google Cloud to allow very, very high performance data exchange between these worker nodes in that Kubernetes cluster. We do things at the lower level in terms of how we integrate with local NVMe SSD drives that, again, depend on the fact that we really understand the Intel architecture to allow data to stream directly off these SSDs straight into the L3 cache of the Intel CPUs. We do a ton of low-level optimizations, so it means within your Kubernetes environment, you only have to run a fraction of the number of EC2 instances to outperform the competition. And we're not interested in just throwing money, throwing resources, and expecting customers to do that, to buy their way out of performance issues. We want to drive the most effective, performant solution that we can with the minimal cost.
Christina, any final thoughts or questions before we start wrapping up?
I think that was a really nice sneak peek into how you could build a data warehouse at scale that would work on many different environments. So thank you for providing us that insight, Mark. I think it's your time to pitch in any additional resources that our listeners can look into further to learn more about the architecture of your platform, for instance.
You know, we have white papers on our website. We have lots of documentation that goes into the details. We have a very long 30 or 40 page sort of deep dive into Yellow Brick. If you have trouble sleeping at night, you can. But the best way to get to know Yellow Brick is to get your hands on it. And so I encourage everyone listening to go to our website, sign up for our free trial. You can get instant access to an instance of Yellow Brick that actually we're hosting, and you can play around with it, and we'd love your feedback.
Awesome. Mark, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
No, likewise. Thanks so much.